I also remember here. I think it was just the two of them, and when they showed up, the prisoners said, "Well, great. They sent the preschoolers to preach to us this afternoon or this evening." And so he said they made fun of he and his friend. They made fun of the music that they did, and they didn't laugh at his jokes. And so I said, "Well, now you know how your daddy feels many times, and that just kind of comes with the territory." So anyway, it's been a good experience for him, and I'm just grateful for our church and for Nashville and what is done through Highview Baptist Church, both in the prisons and in the jails, and the efforts that we make to reach out and share the gospel, to minister to these men and women. A little over a year ago, I did go to the women's prison. I doubt I've ever had any experience that was more sobering and in one sense uplifting, and at the same time, as you left, and most of the women in the prison have children, it just burdened me to no end. And so I'm grateful for what we try to do and the faithful witness that we bring to bear in those contexts. And it's something that makes me very proud that our church is involved in. Let me invite you this evening to take your Bible and join me in Song of Solomon, chapter 3, beginning with verse 6. And we're going to study through verse 11 as we talk about the exciting and wonderful subject of how to have a great wedding. We have come to the wedding of Solomon and Shulamith. We have been building toward this day, and now the day has finally arrived. And in all of the beauty of the Near Eastern rituals that would surround a wedding, we have it implied and even explicated and made clear in these verses. Song of Solomon, chapter 3, and beginning with verse 6. Who is this coming out of the wilderness like pillars of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the merchants' fragrant powders? Behold, it is Solomon's couch, or you may have a translation that I think says it better, carriage, with 60 valiant men around it, of the valiant of Israel. They all hold swords, being expert in war. Every man has his sword on his thigh because of fear in the night. Of the wood of Lebanon, Solomon the king made himself a palanquin, or again, a enclosed chair or a carriage. He made its pillars of silver, its support of gold, its seat of purple, its interior paved with love by the daughters of Jerusalem. Go forth, O daughters of Zion, and see King Solomon with the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, the day of the gladness of his heart. Weddings and marriage for life are out. Cohabitation, trial runs, and prenups are in. That at least would be the picture that you would get about marriage and about weddings if you listen to the prophets of popular culture. I bring a couple of them to the table to speak to us tonight. Monica Schmidt, quote, "It's just a piece of paper to me. I consider myself married without that. There's more freedom. I'm allowed to do whatever I like." John Nielsen, quote, "It's outmoded. It's just as I am just as committed to the relationship as I would be if I were married." Now, I don't have any doubt about that. Claiming to be emotionally abused from his parents' divorce and now in therapy, John adds, quote, "Anything that comes before my recovery has got to go. If I'm not putting myself first, the children are not going to see someone who is looking after themselves." Robin Hill, a woman in a cohabiting arrangement, quote, "I've got a life too. If I thought, oh, this isn't doing anything for me, I'd move on." When asked about a wedding and marriage, she joked, quote, "I thought, well, we do need a new toaster, but I can't see the need to be married." Aline Fesquith and Frank Embert, who entered into a, quote, "civil solidarity pact in France," and I quote their words, "for us living together and adopting this civil solidarity pact is a step forward in our relationship, but without family and all that baggage." Well, the numbers would certainly indicate that cohabiting is the rage of the day. The number of people who are cohabiting in 1960 was 439,000. In 1998, it is 4.2 million, the last date for which we had data concerning this. And with so many now adopting the lifestyle of cohabitation and living together, you would expect that it must be the best thing. It must be the right thing. It certainly must be producing some really good results, correct? Well, no, and I won't bore you with a ton of statistics, but just a few. First, only about 1/6 of live-ins last at least 3 years, and only 1/10 endures 5 years or more. Two, living together before marriage increases the risk of divorce. One study found that it increased your risk for divorce by over 46%. Living together outside marriage increases the risk of domestic violence for women and the risk of physical and sexual abuse for children. One study found that the risk of domestic violence for women in cohabiting relationships was double that in married relationships, and the risk is even greater for children and the potential of child abuse. Number three, couples who live together first are more likely to have an affair during marriage than those who don't. Number four, cohabiting couples are more than 3 times more likely to say, quote, hitting, shoving, and throwing things, close quote, occurred between them and their partner in just the previous year. Perhaps Pamela Smock summarizes the situation well when she writes, while common sense suggests that premarital cohabitation should offer couples an opportunity to learn about each other, increasing their chances for a successful marriage, the evidence suggests just the opposite. Premarital cohabitation tends to be associated with lower marital quality and increased risk of divorce. And so again, I ask the question for us to think about tonight. What's the problem? What's the deal? What in the world is going on? Well, a lady by the name of Rita DeMari said it, I think, best when she wrote, being single is a choice that most people do not choose. People want to be married. However, now you listen to this, however, some people have never seen a good marriage. Because they've never seen a good marriage, they're afraid of it. They're scared of it. Why should they go again through the pain that they've already experienced once in the mistakes and the failures and the shortcomings of their parents? Indeed, for far too many, their perspective on marriage can be summarized 1, 2, 3. First comes the engagement ring. Second, then comes the wedding ring. Third, then comes the suffer ring. And that's what they have experienced, and that's what they have seen. And they basically look at you and me and say, no, thank you. I've already had enough. Perhaps what we could call the case against marriage is not that hard to understand when you again reflect upon what some people have experienced and what some people have seen. And this was really brought home powerfully in a letter or an article that was written just last year by a woman by the name of Larissa Phillips entitled, The Case Against Matrimony, If Marriage is Risky, Doomed, and Expensive, Why Bother? Now, it's rather lengthy, but it is one of the most powerful testimonies and powerful witnesses to the way that Gen Xers and younger view the marriage situation today as a result of the example that has been set for them by far too many of us. Listen to what she wrote. Stay with me now. November the 18th, 1999, the National Marriage Project at Rutgers University announced the findings of a new study. The marriage rate has dropped 43% since 1960, and increasing numbers of young people are choosing to stay unmarried. The U.S. Census Bureau came out with related big news last week. The number of babies born to unwed parents has increased fivefold since the 1930s, owing for the most part to more and more couples rejecting marriage even after the birth of a child. Suddenly, everyone is scrambling, though, to understand. Well, I get it, and I didn't have to scramble to understand. In fact, what interests me is not why the members of my generation, Gen X, if you will, are getting married less, but why is anyone surprised? What did everyone expect? I.e. the baby boomers, what did you expect? Now listen, as the unmarried mother of a new baby, I am the object of much indignation, scrutiny among the older generations who seem to have conveniently forgotten the past 30 years in which almost everyone I know has been emotionally pummeled in some way by divorce. As my boyfriend asked at a recent family gathering while playing a board game in which you have to prompt the other players to supply a particular word, quote, "What must you do before you get married?" The answer, of course, was get divorced. My father and his wife, catch that? My father and his wife, they thought this was hilarious. And yet aging boomers seem shocked and befuddled that someone would choose to avoid the whole swampy mess of broken vows and failed traditions that they've left in their wake. People over 40 flinched with disdain when I first announced my pregnancy. "Oh," they would exclaim, barely masking their disapproval, "and what do your parents think?" They struggled to understand my lack of panic. "Are you going to keep it?" they asked, wide-eyed, as if the 60s, 70s, and 80s never happened. As if at least one-third of marriages don't fail. As if everyone in my family and my boyfriend's family, grandparents included, hadn't broken their marriage vows at least once. Now, it's unbelievable to listen to what she's about to throw at us. "What's with all these people in our family having babies without getting married?" my middle-aged uncle, who is divorced and recently broke up with his live-in girlfriend, asked my 40-ish aunt, who recently divorced her husband because he'd taken up with a married woman who's now his third wife. By the way, my aunt is also now living with her boyfriend. "The worst is from my parents." Quote, "Marriage is very important," my mother said. "It establishes a bond that you just can't get otherwise." I wanted to argue with her, but she was getting ready to leave the country with her new husband. They spend their summers at their cottage up in Nova Scotia, a good 20-hour trip away from the rest of us. Studies show that married couples are better off financially than single people, my father's youngest second wife insisted. It's probably true that she's better off financially since marrying my dad, but I wasn't sure how that applied to me. When my boyfriend and I looked into getting married, we found out that we would pay an extra $2,000 a year in taxes. If marriage is risky, doomed, and expensive, well, why bother? "You just should," my father offered in that magnanimous, ain't life grand manner he developed shortly after reentering the single scene when I was a teenager. My father's big on the shoulds of life, with some reason. He's always done everything he was supposed to, even as a divorced father. He never even badmouthed my mom, nor did she ever trash him for that matter. But the fact that my parents divorced well, and they really did, doesn't grant them immunity from their actions. The fact that my uncles and aunts and grandparents and family friends felt that they had absolutely no choice other than to divorce doesn't change the outcome. They still got divorced, all of them. They still showed my generation by example and by forcing us to go along with their example that marriage was something easily exited from. Marriage, they said, was not that big a deal. Premarital sex is fine, or at least that's what they implied when they presented their boyfriends and girlfriends at the breakfast table before we were even out of high school. Families, they said, do not need to stay together if things become too boring. I would have more sympathy for divorced people if their lives had improved by getting out of terrible marriages that apparently couldn't be survived for another moment. But the ones I'm familiar with continue to associate with flawed human beings. These second and third marriages still seem to require work, and they still have shortcomings. My mother and father, for example, still struggle with the same issues that plagued their marriage to each other. The only difference is, older and wiser, they both seem more willing to compromise, to sacrifice, and to accept. I am not whining about or regretting the events of the last three decades. When my parents divorced in the late 70s, we children went along with it like troopers. When they started bringing home boyfriends and girlfriends in the 80s, we ultimately accepted these new people into our family. Sometimes the new people went away, and we dealt with the divorces and separations all over again and accepted the new people all over again. Fine, exhausting, but fine. It's a wonder we 18 to 35 year olds even have the energy to date, and maybe some of us don't. But for myself, the scattered patchwork concept of family I grew up with has only increased my quest for, now listen to this, has only increased my quest for commitment. I've seen firsthand the pain and futility of the divorce culture, and I don't intend to relive it or to drag my children through the nightmare of watching their parents flirt with strangers. My decision not to marry does not indicate a desire for a life of debauchery and half-formed commitments, quite the opposite, but we have no fantasies about coasting through the next 50 years on the coattails of a weakened and disparaged contract that, thanks to boomer innovation, now includes options like prenup clauses. Considering everything we've seen, bearing the weight of our relationship on our own back seems a blank of a lot wiser than leaning on the white-laced and satin-cummerbunded follies of our parents. Thanks. But we're looking for more than just a party, a round of toast, and a validity stamp from Uncle Sam to get us to that golden anniversary. Our parents, on the other hand, seem to believe in marriage more than they do in monogamy. Like I said, that's fine. Every generation has its torch to carry. But when this particular generation, which grooved to its own beat and stomped on every tradition that seemed too square, too inhibiting, or just plain boring, turns around with nostalgia in its eyes and questions my choices, I have to protest. My generation would just as soon steer clear of the feel-good mess of getting divorced and remarried. The tradition that was passed down to us, in which divorce is a logical and expected conclusion to a marriage, is one we would just as soon pass by. Of course, marriage is on the decline, but don't blame us. You boomers, you are the ones who started it. Now, folks, that's not pretty, but it's correct. It's accurate. And many of our kids and grandkids look at us and say, "What in the world did you leave for us to follow?" And yet, in all the stories that I read and all the testimonies I gave a moment ago, there was one common thread that ran through every one of them that can be answered with just a simple question, and that question is this: where was God in all of this? In every testimony and in this lengthy story that I read about this girl and her family and extended family on both sides of her life and her boyfriend's life, I asked the question, where was God? After all, marriage was his idea. God gave us the pattern, God gave us the plan, and the fact of the matter is, if God would just have been inserted into the equation, I strongly suspect that there would have been a significantly different outcome in most, if not all, of those relationships that went bad. So I know that in a sense tonight I'm preaching to the choir, but at the same time I want to make the case again that when it comes to marriage, God gave us a good gift. But that good gift will only be explored and experienced if we indeed allow God to lead us and direct us to do marriage His way, and also tonight, to begin at the very forefront with the wedding that God planned and that God desired for you and I to experience from the very beginning. And so I want us to focus for a few moments on Song of Solomon chapter 3, verses 6 through 11, and see what it is that the Bible says a God-honoring wedding looks like, with the prayer that growing out of a God-honoring wedding will be a God-honoring marriage. What you find in chapter 3, verses 6 through 11 is truly beautiful and fantastic, and there are at least four things that come out of this text that I believe would indicate to you and to me what it is that is necessary for us in God's eyes to have a great wedding. Number one, A great wedding will be a public celebration. Verse 6, who is this coming up out of the wilderness like pillars of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the merchants' fragrant powders? Behold, it is Solomon's carriage. A wedding should indeed be one of the most exciting and important days in our lives. It is a day that God designed, except for death, to be experienced only one time. It should be a day, as the text implies, of joy and laughter, of happiness and hope. And in particular, I think there are two things that this first verse would indicate that ought to be true of this public celebration. Number one, a wedding is a time that should be special. Now, let me put it in its context. In Solomon and Shulamite's day, a wedding was more of a civil affair than a religious affair. In fact, the whole thing would begin by the groom making his way to the home of his bride, taking her unto himself, and then making a ride back, usually to his home, where there would be a grand celebration surrounding the wedding. It is the case that on the first day, the wedding would be officially brought to pass, and the wedding would be consummated that first evening. And yet it is also the case that the wedding itself would be a great festival, a great party, sometimes lasting up to a week. And so what you have here in verse 6 is the initial picture of Solomon coming out to get his bride. He has gathered her unto himself, and now he is making this wonderful processional ride back to his home, where their marriage will be celebrated and their marriage will be consummated. It is a time of great pageantry. It is a time of great celebration. It is a time, and it is done in a way that would honor the bride and that would sanctify this day as a great and significant and special day in their lives. In the same way, when we are part of a wedding, it ought to be a time that is a grand celebration, a time that is special, and it is not inappropriate for us indeed to be somewhat extravagant in praising that day and honoring that day, because I do believe that outside of our relationship with Christ and the day that we met Him, this ought to be the grandest and most wonderful day that we will ever know in our lives. It is a day that should be special. But secondly, it is also a day in which to make a statement. You notice that this is a public entourage. This is a public processional. Solomon wants the world to know how he feels about this woman. He wants the world to know how special she is. He's not marrying her behind closed doors. He's not running off to Las Vegas and getting a quickie marriage certificate. He plans this. He publicizes it. It is something to draw attention to her and to this special day for all of the world to see. Now, in particular, the text says, like pillars of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the merchant's fragrant powders, behold, it is Solomon's carriage. What you have here is myrrh and frankincense mingled with other great spices and other great powders of merchants. Burning these would appeal both to the sense of sight, seeing the smoke go up, but it would also appeal to the sense of smell, smelling the lovely, costly spices and fragrance that would be being burned as the carriage made its way toward his home. Again, without being opulent, without being ostentatious, without going overboard. And yes, we live in a day where some people spend, I think, an inordinate amount. At the same time, it is a time to celebrate. It is an event in which it is appropriate to express your love and commitment and devotion to your mate in a way that is transparent to them. And it is public to all that this is indeed a great day of celebration as the two of you begin a lifetime together. Therefore, a great wedding will be a public celebration. But now, secondly, a great wedding contains a promise of protection. Verse 7 and verse 8, behold, it is Solomon's carriage with 60 valiant men around it of the valiant of Israel. They all hold swords, being expert in war. Every man has his sword on his thigh because of fear in the night. When Solomon came for Shulamith, he did not come alone. He brought his companions. In fact, he brought his very best, an escort of striking presence and power and authority enables Solomon to come for her, and in the process, again, to make two statements to his bride. Number one, this marriage that you and I are going to enter into, it will provide safety. The sixth and valiant are mighty men, were friends of the groom. They were also Solomon's closest and most trusted confidant. Based upon 2 Samuel 23, verses 8 and 9, we might be on good ground of identifying them ultimately as his royal bodyguard, whose assignment was to protect the king and his family. By their presence, he pledges to the Shulamite woman safety. He pledges to her that as they surround the coach or surround the carriage, that she will be safe under his protective care and concern. In essence, he says, I will spare nothing. I will hold back nothing, but I give my very best to assure your heart and your mind that you will indeed be well taken care of. A marriage, as a man pledges his life to a woman and as she pledges her life to him, should indeed contain within it a provision, a covenant of mutual safety for one another. But secondly, and related to it, is the idea of security. Notice how these valiant men are described. They all hold swords. They are expert in war. Every man has his sword on his thigh. Why? Because of fear in the night. What does the text say about these companions, these best men, these groomsmen, these friends of Solomon? It says, well, first of all, they are experienced and skilled in battle, in war. If Shulamite has any fears about what may be down the road, if she has any fears about how well she will be protected and be secure, she can put those fears to rest. Even at night, when wicked and evil men go about and do their shameful deeds, as she lies in her bed, as she resides in her home, she can be at peace. She can know that all is safe and secure. Her man promises to see to that. He is going to be her champion. He is going to be her defender. He indeed will provide a place of safety and security. Solomon, in essence, is saying, our relationship will not be a shaky relationship. There should be no nagging doubts in your mind or unanswered questions. You're not marrying some cad who will abuse you or put you at risk, but rather you are marrying someone who promises to protect you for the rest of his life. And indeed, guys, a real man will be a champion to his wife. A real man will pledge a lifetime of faithful honoring and protection. Tommy Nelson, who is a pastor in Denton, Texas, speaking on this and relating it to the context of the wedding ceremony itself, says this, and I quote, part of the safety and security of the wedding ceremony will be evident in the people who serve as your best man, your maid or matron of honor, groomsman and bridesmaid. Now listen to what he says. Parents, we should pass these words down to our kids and grandkids. Choose godly people who will support you fully in the vows you make. As a whole, those who witness your marriage should be like a holy hedge of protection around you, keeping you focused toward each other inside the circle of matrimony and keeping out anybody who might try to destroy your marriage. Now listen to this good counsel. Don't ask someone to stand up for you who isn't completely committed to you, to your marriage, and in general, to the sanctity and value of marriage. Such a person will not encourage you to work through the problems that will arise in your marriage. Such a person will not do the utmost to help you and your spouse when you need help, and they may also embarrass you at the rehearsal dinner. And I might add, having done a few marriages myself, you may have some fool in the wedding party who will try to embarrass you at the wedding ceremony itself as well. And folks, I don't care what you think of those people. Those are not real friends. Those are not the best friends. Those are not the people to call to stand at your side to witness this holy and sacred ceremony and embarrass your bride and embarrass you and show that basically you're not a person of very good or sound judgment. A great wedding contains a promise of protection, starting with the ceremony itself. Number three, a great wedding also includes a pledge of commitment. Verse 9, speaking of the carriage of the wood of Lebanon, Solomon the king made himself a palanquin, or a carriage, or literally a enclosed chair or portable enclosed chair. How did he make it? Well, in addition to the wood of Lebanon, he made its pillars of silver, its support of gold, its seat of purple, and its interior is paved with love by the daughters of Jerusalem. What is the missing word in cohabiting relationships? Answer, it's another C word, the word commitment. When a man and a woman come together and say their I do's, commitment should envelop each and every vow that they make. There is a pledge of commitment physically. There is a pledge of commitment spiritually. There is a pledge of commitment emotionally and personally. Commitment should accompany every pledge and every vow that one makes in their wedding. Now, in particular, I believe this text implies two commitments that are foremost in Solomon's mind by the way he has come for his bride. Number one, in this pledge of commitment, you say to your bride, you say to the groom, you say to your wife, your husband, all that I have belongs to you. All that I have belongs to you. The carriage in which Solomon brought Shulamite, we can just say it this way, it was fine. It was made of the very best materials that money could buy. The wood was from Lebanon. Carr points out that the timbers from these forests were in great demand throughout the ancient Near Eastern world. It was from this wood that Solomon carved his carriage. Added to this, we find that it was made also of pillars of silver and its supports of gold and its seat of purple, speaking of the royalty, perhaps of Solomon the king, but also the fact that he saw himself in marriage as her king and he saw her as his queen. Everything was beautiful. Everything was exquisite. And yes, Solomon, again, held nothing back. This was costly. This was expensive. But it was Solomon's way of saying to Shulamith, I'll hold nothing back. All I have now belongs to you, and you can rest assured in our marriage, from me, you will always get my best. You know, today, sometimes even in marriage, all that we have is not shared with our mate. In 1999, I was sad to learn, now listen to this, that the best-selling book in Amazon.com's marriage category, the best-selling book in Amazon.com's marriage category was, and I quote, How to Write Your Own Premarital Agreement. It's a book on prenuptial contracts. It said a publicist at Source Books, where there hangs a congratulatory plaque for this being the number one book in that category. Kind of funny, isn't it? We put out all these books on love and marriage, and this is the best seller. The tragic commentary on where we are in America today when it comes to our commitments and when it comes to our pledges to one another. Solomon says, no prenuptial arrangement. No prenuptial agreement. I'm not going to ask you to set aside certain things that will be yours for now and forever, and I'll set aside things that will be mine now and forever, but no, all that I have, it now belongs to you. But secondly, he says, all of my love belongs to you, for in the latter part of verse 10, it says, the interior of the palanquin of the carriage was what? Paved with love. How? By the daughters of Jerusalem. It had an unusual interior. It was paved and inlaid with love, designed apparently by the daughters of Jerusalem. Now, some Bible scholars believe that they had actually painted beautiful mosaics on the inside of the carriage that had depictions of scenes of love done in a tasteful and romantic way. Others think that there's kind of a play on words here, and he's simply saying that the seat of gold is inlaid with love. And there's kind of a play on the idea of a bed and a couch, a bed and a carriage, and that all of this is being brought together. I don't know for sure what is the fine detail. I do know this. The main point of the passage is not in doubt. They loved each other. They loved each other. Their carriage was inlaid with gold as a sign, as a symbol of the love that they now held for each other and the love that they would now begin to share with each other for a lifetime. Now, folks, we do live in a day where people do not have a very good understanding or a very good definition of what love really is. Most people attach love with some type of emotional, warm and fuzzy kind of thing, when in actuality, love is nothing like that at all. Now, to try to help us out here, I did provide for you on the handout tonight on the back side something that helps you see the difference between love and lust. And again, as you think about your own children, our grandchildren, who are anticipating marriage, and as the day comes when they may walk up to you and say, Mom, Dad, Grandmama, Granddaddy, I think I found the one that I really love. I think I found the one that I want to marry. I'm convinced and certain that I am in love. Maybe it might be wise for you simply to take this page and say, well, honey, I think that's wonderful. But ask yourself some questions biblically based that might assist you as to whether or not this thing really is love or if it's lust. And time will not allow us to look at it in detail, but we'll just hit the high points. What does love look like? Well, number one, it focuses on the other. Number two, it will lead to satisfaction and fulfillment. Number four, it encourages self-control. Put a star by that one for your kids. It encourages self-control. Number five, it desires to live by the Spirit of God. Number six, it includes Christ in each and every decision. Number seven, it seeks God to gain its desires. Number eight, it is active in preventing sin. Number nine, it nourishes the soul. And number 10, it commits to one another. Indeed, free love is a contradiction of terms. There is always an element of commitment in the word love. On the other hand, lust focuses upon self, what I want, what I would like to have. Secondly, it leads to frustration. Thirdly, it continually wants more and more and more. Number four, it enslaves the self. Number five, it desires to gratify the sinful nature with things that are contrary to the Spirit. Number six, if Christ doesn't fit, then he's excluded. Let's don't let Jesus get in the way of my emotional attachment to this other person. In fact, I'll always say to my own sons and to any teenagers that I talk with, the relationship of dating should always enhance and strengthen and draw you closer to the Lord. And if it doesn't, then you are in a bad relationship and you need to get out. Anything that would draw you away from Christ, mark it down. It is not in the long run going to be a good thing. Number seven, lust sins to gratify its desires. Number eight, lust entices with evil desires. Number nine, lust wars against the soul. Number 10, lust avoids commitment and in the end will lead to tragedy. And so a great wedding includes a pledge of commitment. All that I have belongs to you, and all of my love belongs to you. Fourthly, a great wedding has the approval of others. You know, of all of these that are here, this may be the most practical, and in some ways, now again, listen to me, parents and grandparents, and if any singles are here tonight, please listen to me. This may be the most practical wisdom that we find concerning making the decision of who I'm going to marry in all the Bible. And it's basically two simple things. If it is to be a great wedding, leading hopefully to a great marriage, number one, your friends, those who love you most, will say, this is a good thing. And number two, your family, in whom there's no doubt they love you most, will also say, this is a good thing. Verse 11, go forth, O daughters of Zion, and see King Solomon with the crown with which his mother crowned him on the day of his wedding, the day of the gladness of his heart. Sociologist Barbara DeFoe Whitehead has said recently, and I quote, "Courtship is dying. Lasting marriage is in crisis. Kiss marriage goodbye. Today it's hook up, break up, and get even. Is everybody happy?" Newspaper columnist Suzanne Fields says, "In today's world, women, hey gang, you're losing. And you're losing big time." You say, "What's her evidence?" Well, I know it's anecdotal. But she says, just direct your attention to the self-help sections of our bookstores and look at some of the titles that you will find there. I just took a few of the ones she mentioned. The Heartbreak Handbook, Getting Over Him, How to Heal the Hurt by Hating, Dumped, A Survival Guide for the Woman Who's Been Left by the Man, and my personal favorite, The Woman's Book of Revenge, Getting Even When Mr. Right Turns Out to Be All Wrong. Great world we're living in, isn't it? Well, you know what? Let's be honest for a moment. Sometimes Mr. Right does turn out to be Mr. Wrong. Hey, guys, sometimes Cinderella turns out to be a wicked witch. Now, that's just the way life works sometimes. You say, well, can you at least help me out? At least on the front end of things that I might avoid making a bad choice and a bad decision like that? Yeah, I just gave it to you. Number one, look for your friend's approval. And number two, look for your family's approval. Notice the text says, the daughters of Zion, they go forth to join in the celebration of the wedding. They approve. They are enthused. In their mind, it is a good thing and a wonderful thing that is about to happen as Solomon and Shulamith married. I think this would be true if we could have talked to them. They would say, Solomon, is he better or is he worse when he's with her? It's a great question to ask. Is he a better guy, a more likable guy, or is he the other? And they would have said, I want to tell you what, Solomon is at his best when he's with her. She has this unbelievable magnetic way of drawing out the very best in him. And by the way, those who were friends of Shulamith would have said the same thing. She's a more beautiful, a better, and a more attractive woman when she is with Solomon. Your friends will approve because they see the best coming out of you when you are with this person. But secondly, your friends will approve. You'll notice from the text that there's not going to be any mother-in-law problems in this relationship, at least for the Shulamite woman. Solomon's mother says, honey, you found the right girl, and she makes that evident by basically weaving for him the laurel wreath, a crown that would be a symbol not of his kingship, but rather a symbol of the gladness and joy of his wedding day. In my study for this, I discovered that the rabbinic tradition teaches us that from the time of Solomon all the way up until AD 70 when Jerusalem was destroyed, it was the custom in a wedding ceremony for both the groom and the bride to adorn their head with a crown. Why? Because in the eyes of that man, this lady was now his queen. In the eyes of this woman, this man now is to be her king. And they indeed said, what is happening here is something that can only be graced by royalty. And so his friends, his family say, we're confident that this marriage is a good thing. We're confident that this marriage was meant to be and meant to last, and gladly and joyfully they all pledge their approval. On April the 13th, the year 2000, this year, a very unusual thing happened on a campus of a Baptist seminary in Wake Forest, North Carolina. Approximately 550 couples, hand in hand and heart to heart, reaffirmed their marriage vows in a worship service and also signed a covenant pledging to, quote, exalt the sacred nature and permanence of the marriage covenant. The vows were penned by Dr. Page and Dr. Dorothy Patterson, the president of Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary, and the words themselves are a beautiful reflection of what we read in the Song of Solomon and also in Ephesians chapter 5, verses 21 through 33. I do believe that what was said that day was a marvelous expression of the covenantal commitment that a husband and a wife should pledge to each other both on their wedding day, but also that they should continually pledge to one another all of the days of their life. And as we close, simply listen to the words that first the men said to their wives, and then the wives to their husbands. The men, seek your well-being, happiness, and success rather than my own. I will compassionately give to you my body and spirit in the union which we alone enjoy together. This day, I seal this covenant for as long as we both shall live. Would you pray with me as we close? Heavenly Father, I thank you so much that when we come to that wonderful day of wedding, that if we will come to it with a commitment first of all to you and then to one another, it can indeed be a great wedding and also the beginning of a great marriage. And Lord, I agree, a wedding should be more than just getting a toaster as a marriage gift. It ought to be a day of marvelous celebration, a day where we pledge protection to one another, a day of commitment, and a day where we indeed seek the blessing and the approval of others, including, most importantly, the blessing and approval of God. And dear Lord, without throwing rocks at anybody, and that has not been my intention this evening, too many marriages have not made it. Too many bad examples have been set. And Lord, it's time for it to be different. It really is. And so Lord, none of us can change the past, but Lord, all of us can affect the future. And so may it be that our kids and grandkids see in us the kind of devotion, the kind of commitment that indeed gives evidence of a great marriage. And Lord, may it be that we would learn from mistakes that we have made, and without being arrogant, without being haughty, without looking down our nose at our children and grandchildren, we might encourage them, love them, and pray for them that they would indeed marry that right person under you. They might indeed experience a great wedding, and that indeed, Lord, it would be the beginning of a marvelous and lifelong great marriage. This is our prayer, Lord, and we acknowledge that it can't be done unless you do it, unless you build the house. And so, Lord, we depend upon you, and we ask you to do what only you can and will do to the honor and glory of the name of Jesus, in whom we pray. Amen. Thank you so much. We'll see you next Wednesday night.